You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of October 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
This is an individual who was described as a lone wolf. I don't know how it could have been prevented if we didn't have any prior knowledge to this individual.
Every developed country but the United States does, however, have some ideas about how events like this can be prevented. My guests Isabel Hilton and Samira Shackle will be here to discuss what we know about the Las Vegas shooting and what, if anything, American lawmakers might have learned from it. We'll also look at the role of fake news, whether our public spaces can really be made more secure than they already are, and whether it matters whether or not we ever know why Stephen Paddock did what he did. That's all coming up on this special edition of Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and the journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the program, in which we will take an extended look at Sunday night shooting in Las Vegas. At least 59 people were killed, nearly 10 times that many injured, when 64-year-old retired accountant Stephen Paddock opened fire on an open-air concert from a 32nd floor hotel room in which he had amassed an arsenal of at least 23 weapons. One of the many questions to which we have no satisfactory answer as yet is that of motive. Isabel, first of all, this is something that police say that they are trying to establish, and obviously for police at least, I guess they want to go out and find out as much as they can in any given investigation. Does knowing why somebody does something like this actually make really any difference to our understanding of it?
Well, I think I'd go back a step and say you'll never really know why. I mean, you can if you look at the post-mortem examination of the lives of mass killers, because most of them die in the instance, very few survive. You know, you can piece together a story of troubled childhood or loneliness or failure in various kinds. That doesn't explain, given that there are thousands of people like that, why one picks up a gun and one doesn't. So the variability, it seems to me, is the availability of lethal weaponry in almost unlimited quantities, which allows for disturbed individuals to act out their rather lethal fantasies. You know, lethal fantasies become more than a private problem when you can, when you have the means to act out. The search for a motive is about the search for meaning. It's about trying to, you know, if you've lost someone or if something traumatic like this has happened at a national level, of course you would rather these events had meaning, but I fear they may not have the meaning except for the one that in the United States it's almost impossible to examine, which is gun availability.
Which we will talk about later in the show, but Samira, the thing that strikes me with the search for motive in an incident like this is that it's not imaginable, at least to me, that anybody's going to come up with one that actually explains it at all, still never mind actually makes this somehow seem less awful than it obviously is. Nobody's going to come up with something that makes people go, oh, well, I see, are they?
I don't think anything ever, you know, really takes the horror out of it, but it's, as Isabel says, it's that search for meaning. It's the urge to sort of make sense of something or to place it into a category of something that we can understand. So, you know, we've had in the latest, just the latest array of mass killings in America, you can sort of put them in boxes. There's San Bernardino motivated by terrorism, the Charleston shooting motivated by racism. In those two cases, it's political ideology. You have other mass shootings which are supposedly motivated or caused by mental illness, etc. So they kind of fit into these boxes, and it's a way of perhaps trying to rationalise violence. I think the sort of argument given would be that understanding the motives might help with prevention, but I think that we've seen, not just in the US but around the world, that that's perhaps of limited use. And I'd agree very much with Isabel that the variable is about the availability of guns. And in that sense, actually, the motivation doesn't matter at all, because the most important thing to discuss is the availability of guns. And we've seen that whether the motivation is Islamist terrorism, whether it's racism and white supremacy, whether it's mental illness, none of those factors or motivations, once supposedly unveiled, has led to any sort of change in policy or limitation of availability. So I wonder if it's useful in practical terms at all.
The only thing we have heard about motivation has been a slightly strange claim from Islamic State that they were responsible and that Mr. Paddock was a recent convert to Islam.
Isabel, well, I think everyone would like that, wouldn't they?
Well, yeah. Yes, but Isabel, I'll ask you, are we as confident as the US authorities have been of dismissing this claim? Nobody seems to be taking this one terribly seriously at all.
I have absolutely no evidence one way or the other, but my immediate response was, you know, a gambling ex-accountant with a property portfolio wasn't in Nevada was not maybe the most likely recruit. Who knows? It would be a fantastic victory for the American right and for Islamic State if this turned out to be true, because, you know, it's a win-win, as it were. They get to blame an ideology they'd be very happy to blame instead of one of the many, you know, other factors that come into play. And Islamic State gets to claim the most unlikely recruit and the most successful hit for a long time. Personally, I doubt it.
Is there a concern at all, Samira, if you do begin to glean the motives or the reasons for something like this, that there's any danger in publicising them for fear of inspiring somebody in a similar situation to do something similar? There's some suggestion that this was done with Martin Bryant, the Port Arthur shooter in Australia 20-odd years ago, that his particular reasons for doing what he did were never fully disclosed for that reason. I'm not persuaded by it myself. I do tend to take the view that somebody who is inspired by something like this to do something similar is probably past being helped by the discretion of the media and authorities.
Halfway to inspiration.
Exactly. I've got to say I'm with you on that. And I think once you get onto the grounds of potentially censoring bits of information and so on, it's quite dangerous ground, I think, for the sake of incidents which are thankfully still pretty rare and pretty unlikely. I think that I wouldn't think that's particularly good line of argument.
The other thing about gun deaths in the United States is that in general terms, it seems to be an almost no-go subject. You can touch it after something like this. 69 people a day die from gun.
Well, you can't after something like this. The White House have said now is not the time to discuss it.
But still, we have had people trying to talk about it. There have been, you know, 142 school shootings since Sandy Hook. It's just a most extraordinary level of slaughter, which is like background noise at this point. It's quite extraordinary.
Well, I mean, yeah, you could certainly take the view that the only remarkable thing about this particular incident is the number of deaths.
Yes.
Other that aside, it is more
it's
or less routine.
Yeah. And what is the difference between someone who kills five people and who kills 50?
Yeah.
You know, it's not necessarily a difference in kind. It's just a difference in volume, opportunity, a bit of planning. You know, but somebody who takes a gun and kills four or five people, apparently in a motiveless way, is very much the same behaviour as somebody who kills a larger number.
Okay, well, let's move along slightly to the question of whether an event such as this has any lessons to impart about how they might be prevented or at least diluted in future. If we're ruling out, that is, the apparently obviously absurd tack of preventing civilians from owning military weapons, the question has already been raised of how Paddock was able to get his arsenal into a hotel suite, but many Las Vegas hotels do not have metal detectors, and even if they did, many of the guns they might detect would, of course, be being possessed and carried entirely legally. Samira, there's always, after something like this, the rush towards something must be done-ism, which is a huge and understandable and not unreasonable temptation. Although, obviously, in this case, they're not going to do the something that actually should be done, i.e. to make it harder for people to buy automatic weapons or semi-automatic weapons. Should it be submitted to in this case? If you were running a Las Vegas hotel, would you be rethinking the security arrangements?
I think probably, although there is also, of course, you know, as you've just alluded to, the fact that, you know, that there's you can scan weapons, but when the most dangerous weapons of all, kind of submachine guns and military equipment, are entirely legal, you sort of question. Well, it's sort of like putting a sticking plaster on a gaping open wound, isn't it? The idea of that, it sort of seems to be a quite inadequate solution to a very systemic problem. I think that it I was sort of reading around about it, and that lots of places don't do things like pat downs and metal detectors, or whatever, just because they think it would be a hassle. It's quite routine in many, many parts of the world that you go through various metal detectors and so on as you go through hotels. I'm always dubious about how effective it is as a tactic, but you know, perhaps in this instance, some eyebrows might have been raised over the fact that he was had 40 weapons or whatever it was, even if it was even if some of them were legal. I don't know. I mean, I don't know actually what the legal status of his weapon ownership was, but nonetheless, it's an odd thing to be taking to a hotel in Las Vegas. But I don't know is the short answer, really, because I think that's so much not what the main issue is. It's obviously not really about the kind of security protocols at an individual hotel. It's about the availability of these weapons in such an easy way.
I mean, yeah, Isabel, would you be particularly reassured if you stayed in an American hotel which did have metal detectors and search? I can't recall myself staying in an American hotel that has them. I've stayed in plenty of hotels in the Middle East, India, Pakistan, which do have some amount of security on the door. But I don't know. I just tend to the view that if you make one place secure in that respect, then somebody who's absolutely determined to do something of the sort will just go and do it somewhere else.
Well, they'll go to the supermarket or wherever. Yeah. But I have to say, when I read that he had 23 guns in his hotel room, including two rifles mounted on tripods, and the staff hadn't noticed anything untoward, presumably quite a lot of ammunition. Think what that must have weighed. You know, whoever had carried his luggage upstairs must have, you know, earned a very large tip indeed.
He might have got a trolley and taken it up himself.
Yeah, but heavy, big, heavy stuff.
Indeed so, but I suppose if it's all bagged up and wrapped up during the day, then again, I have stayed in hotels in the Middle East where they do search your bags when you leave the room, but I'm not sure that that's something that an American hotel is going to think is going to encourage guests.
I wonder if after this they might take another approach, but as you say, you're just going to move. It's like squeezing a soft balloon, as they used to say about the drugs trade. You know, you can get it out of one town and it simply expands into another. And I think that with somebody who has an automatic weapon and an intent to use it, it's really not difficult to find targets. You know, you can sit in your car and spray out of the back of the car. It's too easy.
Samira, is there a reasonable point? It has been made by a few people suggesting that Las Vegas hotels in particular have incredibly tight security measures on the casino floors aimed at spotting card counters and other people seeking to game the games, as it were, but they don't appear to be able to stop people carrying an arsenal of automatic weapons and semi-automatic weapons into a hotel room.
Yeah, it's about, I suppose the argument that the hoteliers would make would be that that's about what's more likely and that you have a much higher prevalence of sort of people trying to game the gambling than to commit mass atrocities, which is probably true. And I think that in some cases, you know, having spent lots of time in places where there are lots and lots of security measures everywhere you go, I think that an argument can be made about proportionality and about not sort of... kind of making everything feel much less livable because of the sake of a quite unusual instance. However, I do think this was so extreme, and it kind of boggles the mind that someone could have been carrying that many weapons and set up their hotel room as a kind of war room and not been picked up at all. You just wonder if maybe some security measures...
This is something.
But it's very unusual, isn't it?
It is. Well, the whole thing is odd, obviously. Yeah. But this is something we don't yet know how he was able to do this. Whether it was all just done with the awesome deterrent power of the Do Not Disturb sign hung on the doorknob. But just thinking about the hotels, especially the Las Vegas ones, Isabel, and with all due respect, that there is an element of bolted horses and stable doors about it in this particular instance. Some of these hotels are mega hotels. They have hundreds of rooms. They may have at any particular point thousands of guests. Is it reasonable to expect them to employ sufficient security staff and build sufficient security apparatus to search all of those people?
Well, nevertheless, they do have entrances and exits. exits and rather, you know, more constricted space. You know, so would a metal detector at the door be that intrusive? Mm. I mean, the arguments that I've read have been that these high rollers don't particularly like people questioning their gun carrying or even asking if they are carrying guns. I don't know if an incident like this changes their view of that. It may not. And as you say, it is a little bit of closing the stable door. I'm also curious to know whether there is any way in the United States, if somebody is acquiring 40 guns, including a lot of armor-piercing or high-velocity or automatic weapons, whether there's any national register that could be used to track that, because that's an awful lot of guns, and you can claim that you're a collector, but it's still deviant behavior. I mean, if you're looking at what you could really do about this, given that you can't stop Americans carrying guns, it seems to me that we have to get a little bit smarter about trying to track the behavior that might indicate that something odd is going on with an individual. Yeah, his family didn't know that he had guns. They knew he had a few handguns, but nothing on this scale. He was acquiring explosives. I mean, these are very kind of big signals in a country that, for example, is obsessed with terrorism. You know, if he had been, would he have been watched more closely if he hadn't been a white accountant?
Well, as we said before, he very much doesn't fit the profile of either, as we've understood at least in Europe, the Islamist terrorist, or even the spree killer in America, which do they tend to be white males, certainly, they tend to be several decades younger.
Yes.
We're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Samira Shackle and Isabel Hilton. After a very short break, more on Las Vegas.
Monocle has bureau around the world in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In Toronto, our bureau chief is Thomas Lewis.
Torontonians like to think of this place as one of the most diverse and one of the most tolerant anywhere in Canada, if not anywhere in the world. And the energy that brings off, I think, is really fertile ground for a journalist, a bureau chief, for Monocle as a whole to tap into and to play a key part in.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Samira Shackle and Isabel Hilton. Now, the shooting in Las Vegas had barely stopped before the actually useful or accurate information being posted on social media and the internet in general started struggling to be heard beneath the inevitable racket of disinformation, conspiracy theories and ill-timed prankery, all of it promoted to undue prominence by algorithms which still struggle to differentiate between legitimate news outlets and malicious trolls. Samira, it's a question that gets asked about social media increasingly these days, not just in the immediate aftermath of an event like this, but are they actually doing enough? Have they become too comfortable with the idea of themselves as do what thou wilt free-for-alls?
Yeah, I think that there's such a fear amongst the big tech companies of appearing partisan that they've kind of ceded their responsibility on this matter. And actually, it is really important. We've had this discussion repeatedly after the American election, after the Brexit referendum and at various other points that, you know, we've got 2/3 of people or something like that accessing news primarily through Facebook or social media. And so it is really important that they can differentiate what's a reputable news source and what isn't. There's this fear about, as I said, about appearing partisan. There's a reluctance, largely because of that fear, reluctance to have sort of human editors and fact checkers sifting stuff and instead relying on kind of rules-based algorithms, which are very easily gamed, as we've seen in various instances, including over this Las Vegas shooting. And I think there is a responsibility to do more because the way that we consume information is so different now that the big tech companies who are profiting off people using it can't just sort of stand back and say, well, we're just a marketplace for ideas, we have to leave it. So I think it has such a profound impact on how we consume and understand news events.
See, I just wonder whether what we're seeing here in the same way that we see the fetishizing, if that's the word, of the Second Amendment means that nothing can be done about gun control, whether there's an equal fetishizing of the First Amendment, the freedom of speech one, which afflicts the tech giants. It's always struck me that a platform like Twitter or Facebook, it's a public arena. It's like a bar or it's a cafe. And if somebody came into your bar or cafe behaving like that, you'd throw them out. You haven't therefore abrogated their freedom of speech. You've just said to them, you can't do it in here.
Probably harder with Twitter, but certainly Facebook, since it is now a news platform amongst all its other functions, to blame an algorithmic error for the fact that a blatant piece of misinformation, malicious misinformation, was high and trending for so long immediately after the event, is weak and feeble. You know, you either rely on algorithms and make them work, but blaming an algorithmic error doesn't seem to me to be very smart. And I think that, you know, what we see again repeatedly with these episodes, and we saw it after Sandy Hook, is an immediate response from 4chan, from alt-right sources, mm-hmm. which create a great deal of fog around these episodes. So in this case, you know, the killer identified as a liberal, Trump-hating, you know, Clinton-voting, et cetera, again, the usual cast, this then appears on a Russian website. It gets promoted around the place. Sandy Hook is a particularly outrageous case in which an entire conspiracy has been built around the killing of 7-year-old children, 20 of them, by a you know, deranged young man, to say that this never happened. And this has been promoted on Shock Jock Radio. It has appeared in, you know, those alt-right circles. I don't know if it's actually appeared on Breitbart News, but it's been promoted by a contributor to Breitbart News. You know, I really do think that these things have to be, there has to be a way of stopping them.
You will be unsurprised to learn that similar theories are already circulating about Las Vegas and will doubtless continue to do so. Yeah. Samira, Snapchat does, in fact, which is in fairness, a much smaller concern than Twitter or Facebook, but it does employ a team of journalists to check stories. Mm. Is it worth thinking about whether, not just whether Facebook and Twitter should do that, but perhaps whether they should be compelled to?
Yeah, I think there definitely is, because they're not doing it, and so I wonder at what stage they will start to do it. And I believe Facebook actually got rid of some editors and so on because they'd been accused of suppressing conservative news sites, and they just had this terror about appearing to be partisan one way or another. But I do think it's really important, and if they're not, if the tech companies aren't complying with it, then I think there has to be some sort of regulation about it, because as you say, it's not about the suppression of free speech. It's about sort of how those ideas get elevated. And if, as these sort of 4chan-type groups, the Russian state apparatus, as we've seen, all sorts of actors are very efficient at learning and gaming algorithms in order to elevate their ideas, that's a very, very different thing to having freedom of speech. I mean, people have the right to say what they want. They don't have the right to get it to reach a mass market and have the same gravitas as a sort of reputable news source.
Okay, well, finally tonight, the Las Vegas shooting will, of course, reignite the gun control debate in the United States, in which both sides will say all the things they say every time something like this happens, and after which nothing will change. One potential focus of dispute this time is what Republicans are pleased to call the Hearing Protection Act, which will make it substantially easier to buy silencers for guns, in theory, to protect the ears of hunters and their hounds. There's some chatter in the last couple of hours that even the GOP have decided that it might be in poor taste to proceed with that one for the time being, at least. So that's something. But Isabel, first of all, it's a question I have asked various American pundits and gun control experts at various points, and just. Which is that, is it at this stage even possible to imagine the crime so dreadful that it would prompt Americans to have a serious think about guns? To which one of them did reply, "How many more presidents do you want us to shoot?" But it's not going to change, is it?
Well, I think if 27-year-olds didn't do it, I'm not sure what would. Honestly, it does appear to be completely impossible even to have a reasonable conversation about how you might begin to nibble at the edges of this problem. There is no legitimate use for a machine gun in hunting. There is no legitimate use for these armor-piercing automatic weapons except to kill quite large numbers of people in a very short time. And it doesn't seem to me beyond the wit of man to observe the right to bear arms, but to restrict the categories of arms that you have the right to bear. There is nothing in the First Amendment says, the Second Amendment, which says you have the right to carry armor-piercing automatic weapons. You know, it's not there. There is ground on which you can argue, and there surely it's not beyond the wit of a state with an intelligence apparatus as sophisticated as the United States to monitor and track those who buy guns and to observe those who buy suspicious quantities of very dangerous weapons.
There's a problem, though, isn't there, Samira, that guns have become not just guns. I was talking about this earlier, that when there was a big buyback in Australia following the Port Arthur massacre, which got something like 600,000 guns out of circulation with a relative minimum of fuss. But it struck me that in Australia, people tend to regard guns as tools. They have no more particular sentimental import than, you know, a shovel or an axe. But in America, they have acquired this totemic aspect, haven't they? People think it's part of their identity.
Yeah, absolutely. They think it's part of their identity as Americans. It's a kind of signifier of freedom and sort of connection to this great American heritage. But as Isabel says, you know, the founding fathers, when they designed the Constitution, did not have these types of weapons in mind. It was perfectly possible to preserve the right to bear arms and all the sort of symbolism that contains, hard as that might be to understand from the perspective of, you know, sitting here in a studio in London. But it's possible to preserve that while also restricting the sales of certain types of weapons, which have no purpose other than to kill really large numbers of people. And I think that it should be possible for policymakers to make that argument, but no one seems to be willing to.
I mean, Isabel, how big a political and, not wishing to sound glib, but personal risk would it be for any US politician who decided they really wanted to take this on? Especially given that the odds against success, I think, are pretty considerable.
The odds are considerable. I mean, actually, it's one of those issues that if you look at the polling, you know, half of the country is with them on this. But it's the other half who are both well-funded and dangerous, who are the danger. And as we see with things like climate change, if you launch yourself into one of these rather toxic issues, you become a target not only for people with guns but for people with money. So you know, you're quite likely to lose your seat, and you are, you know, it's not unlikely that you might be shot. So it's difficult.
So Samira, if this doesn't change anything, do we just have to understand and accept that this is just what America is like?
Well, that's the kind of, that seems like the obvious reading of it, but I guess you have to be optimistic. And it might be that, you know, if they haven't had the big drastic moment, which is, as well says, if it didn't happen after Sandy Hook, it's hard to imagine what would prompt it if it wasn't that. I think that the incremental change is still possible. It's possible. I don't hold out high hopes for the current administration, but it is possible, since there's no signs of shootings reducing, that there might be incremental change over the next decades.
Well, that brings us to the end of today's show. Samira Shackle and Isabel Hilton, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Alessio Dallana. Our studio manager was Christy Evans. More on the latest developments in Las Vegas and the day's other stories coming up on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. I'm Andrew Millip. Thanks for listening.